You'll no doubt have seen television programs where computer visualization techniques demonstrate how the pyramids were built, or the construction of Tudor ships like the Mary Rose, or the nature of Viking settlements and burials. Archaeology has long used visualization tools like virtual reality, but these tools are also proving useful in theater research. Today, I will show you a virtual reality model of the late 16th century Rose Theater. This technology can assist us to discover much more about how performance took place in the early modern era than has been established from archives and from the reconstruction of Shakespeare's Globe Theater here in London. My work to this point has focused on Christopher Marlowe's play, Dr. Faustus, which was known to have been performed at the Rose. It has piqued my interest about other complicated staging propositions. Today, I explore the logistics of selected staging devices in other plays of the time and what these devices might mean for performance. I look at items that elicit wonder or spectacle and that are often associated with magic of some sort. It's not the item's supernatural status per se that I'm investigating, but rather how they could have been brought to the stage in the Rose. This assists us in understanding the plays in their own time, as well as their performance today. Just one note, my original title also included the Boar's Head Theatre, but the material on the Rose has proved more plentiful than I could have imagined, so I'm focusing just on it. First, the theatre. The Rose, where Marlowe's plays and many of Shakespeare's early plays were performed, operated as a theater from 1587 to 1603 and was demolished in 1606. This virtual reality construction in front of you was generated by Ortelia, a software company that designs virtual reality versions of cultural spaces. An Ortelia virtual environment begins with the creation of a 3D model of a venue developed from the geometry and the dimensions of the actual site. In the case of the Rose, that is the theater's foundations, which were excavated in 1989. So this is based on the actual foundations, not on speculations or drawings. The model, which uses Quest 3D software, which is a game engine as the platform, is then textured with images that illustrate the surface detail. In the case of the Rose, the thatch that was appropriate to the day and oak beams. Ortelia's models are easy to use, employing conventional gaming tools. They require a mouse and four keys, either the letters W, A, S, and D keys or the arrow keys. We have incorporated documented renovations to the building to show the theater with a temporary stage. Do you want to just go to the temporary stage, Sarah? Number one. The temporary stage gives us the opportunity to think of what the venue might have been like if it were used as a bear baiting arena. So there's, I'm sorry, I said temporary stage, Sarah. I meant without any stage. Here's the temporary stage. And then the next two versions, which Sarah will show, document the renovations that were made in 1592 and 1594. The virtual model is also designed to take account of ceiling heights, of the size of individual stairs, of average citizen height, and construction methods appropriate to the day. We've been surprised by how intimate the theater is. While numerous commentators note its small scale, the model makes starkly clear just how its size would have affected performance. It is also very dark. Given that the venue's position in relation to the sun is known, we have been able to account for the angle of the sun at different times of the day and the year. Even in summer, the upper galleries would likely have required some artificial light for patrons to access their seats on all but the sunniest days. And this begs a question about artificial lighting, which we can take up later. So Sarah has just shown you the what it would look like in the Rose at different times of the day, since we actually do know where it sits vis-a-vis the sun. The avatar that you will see performing shortly was created by Matthew Delbridge, a motion capture expert. The figure will perform the final monologue from Dr. Faustus. I'll pause for a moment and just let him speak.
Ah, Faustus. Now thou hast but one bare hour to live, and then thou must be damned perpetually. Stand still, thou ever-moving spheres of heaven, that time may cease, and midnight never come. Fair nature's eye, rise, rise again, and make perpetual day, or let this hour be but a year, a month, a week, a natural day, that Faustus may repent and save his soul. O lente, lente, curite, noctis equi! Stars move still. Time runs, the clock will strike, the devil will come, and Faustus must be damned.
I will leap up to my God. Who pulls me down?
See? See where Christ's blood streams through the firmament. One drop would save my soul. Half a drop. Ah, Christ. Oh, rend not my heart for naming of my Christ, yet will I call on me.
Oh, spare me, Lucifer.
Oh, where is it now? 'Tis gone.
Okay, that's a flavor of our motion capture, Dr. Faustus. I can explain a little bit more later, if you wish, about how he was created. The basis of that character is two Shakespeare-trained actors. The voice is obviously from one of them, but the body shape is two of them merged, combined. Sarah will demonstrate one stage property that we've developed for Dr. Faustus, and that is Hellmouth. I want to just move them. I won't play Dr. Faustus at this time. He just runs on a loop, and luckily we can turn him on and off. And there's our Hellmouth. We worked long and hard to work out the scale of Hellmouth and how it would work on this particular stage. I can explain a little bit more about that later, too. But just roughly, there are ribs, as it were, to give him the shape. I wanted a Hellmouth that Dr. Faustus could get swallowed by, could actually enter. So in order to do that, we needed ribs to give him that scale. The Hellmouth can be stored standing up backstage, and if you wish, there can even be smoke that can be passed through him from the back to the front with bellows. We have taken a few liberties, of course, with the color. Okay, now one of the issues that has emerged from the work to date is just how crowded the stage and the tiring house would have been, filled with numerous actors and the many large props that were required for Marlowe's theater. This is well enough known, but witnessing just how cramped the conditions would have been suggests the need to reevaluate performance on such a stage. And I can show you some examples of this afterwards if you like. Now, my aim today is to demonstrate a new way to think about theater research that combines existing methods with new technologies. I've selected plays that were performed at the Rose and that deploy stage properties such as fire, dragons, and raised and lowered items. These are devices that can be difficult for us to imagine being deployed in outdoor theaters then. My sample plays are Thomas Lodge and Robert Greene's A Looking Glass for London and England, Thomas Dekker's Old Fortunatus, and Robert Greene's Friar Bacon and Friar Bungay. I've steered away from Shakespeare's plays because they receive most of the critical focus. But of course, what occurs on stage with the plays I've chosen for today would compare closely with the performance of Shakespeare's plays in this venue. It is easy to assume how performance took place when one is speculating about a venue to which we no longer have access, and when one needn't worry about scale, practicalities, orientation, etc. The VR Rose provides a much better sense of what was possible, what this venue could have sustained, and what that could have meant for performance at the time. My plan is to challenge convention to some extent. Over 100 years ago, the experiments conducted by William Pohle into the performance of Shakespeare and his contemporaries reacted against the illusionistic style of high Victorian-era Shakespeare productions by Herbert Beerbohm Tree, among others. Beerbohm Tree's A Midsummer Night's Dream, complete with live rabbits on stage, was notoriously elaborate and expensive. Edward Moore notes that Pohle's dissatisfaction with the sensational and stagey soon led him to question the whole method of staging Shakespeare. He was interested in seeing Shakespeare's text put on stage. Pohle's extremely bare productions rejected illusion, opting for minimal scenery and stage properties to focus, among other things, on Shakespeare's language, meaning, and intention. While many features of Pohle's legacy are in turn rejected today, aspects of his approach dominate the received wisdom about the Elizabethan stage. Joe Filoco calls Pohle's approach in the late Victorian and Edwardian era the minimalist aesthetic of the Elizabethan revival. This aesthetic often stands in for staging in the Elizabethan era as well. The comparative bareness of the Elizabethan stage does, however, need to be understood in context. While the spectacle of the Elizabethan stage was not akin to Beerbohm Tree's extravaganzas, other data demonstrates that the theater in Shakespeare's day presented more visuality than Pohle's experiments often imply. As Alan Dessen and others articulate, the stage directions in early modern plays yield a wealth of spectacle, a commodity that has been significant for theater from the ancient Greeks to today. The range of spectacular theatricality expands significantly in court masques and after the Restoration, but the pre-Restoration public theater still had its share of spectacle. Tom Bishop maintains that the use of stage spectacle to wow audiences was a regular part of English drama around 1600. Serlio, the Italian architect, documented flying machines for theater in the early 16th century, while Philip Henslow, the owner of the Rose Theater, cataloged various stage properties for delivering a spectacular experience. Henslow's records have been vital in establishing what might have been possible in this venue, confirming what Jonathan Sade argues, that the early modern era was very far from being a paleotechnic desert. The lack of information about such machines is likely partly associated with the absence of the theaters. But there is also the situation whereby many early modern plays promise significant spectacle, whether through magic, battles, special effects, or whatever, and then fail to deliver. For instance, in Friar Bacon and Friar Bungay, Friar Bacon's promised encircling of London in a protective brass wall does not take place for reasons associated with the complex narrative. Other failed spectacles could be the result of tired costumes, machinery that breaks down, or less than convincing vanishings, among others. Jeremy Lopez argues that the potential for dramatic representation to be ridiculous or inefficient or incompetent was a constant and vital part of audiences' experiences of the plays. This suggests that the spectacular effects that do take place successfully must be remarkable enough to keep an audience's attention, particularly when, Cara Riley notes, audiences were knowledgeable about the devices that were available. Riley clarifies the place of spectacle in the form of the automaton, arguing that statues that were smashed in the church by iconoclasts are remembered, literally put back together in the secular theater in the form of hydraulic moving statues. This, she maintains, signals ongoing cultural anxieties about these images. I'm sorry, I've skipped a line. This signals ongoing cultural anxieties about the persuasive power of images. Whatever the anxieties about these images, theater was a key location for exploring their figuration. Closely related to spectacle was the concept of wonder. The Renaissance was, Peter Platt outlines, fascinated by wonder, which, he argues, could be evoked by the usual Aristotelian ignorance and surprise, but also by the plots and subject matter of fiction, whether wizards, monsters, winged horses, unicorns, and by the useful and instructive, and by religious manifestations of the supernatural. This multiple expression of wonder reflects a radically changing worldview, which, as Kristen Poole explains, sees the traditional understanding of a supernatural order competing with a new geometric ordering. The traditional supernatural order manifests in a magic that itself becomes fragmented and in transition. The tensions that arise from this shifting worldview and the form of magic, whether of the natural world or a diabolic realm, are being played out in performance in a theater like the Rose. Yet another way to view this is as a counterpoint between magic and the machine. Not all of you will be familiar with the three plays at the core of today's presentation, so I offer brief summaries. In Lodge and Green's A Looking Glass for London and England, incest, murder, adultery, fraud, and exploitation and more are rife at all levels of society in Nineveh in the 8th century BC. The prophet Oseas provides a choric role, comparing the evils of Nineveh to those of London and promising dire consequences should Londoners not reform their ways. Jonas arrives in Nineveh and preaches repentance. The king and nearly all his subjects repent and are saved from divine retribution. Oseas warns Londoners to follow suit. The elaborate plot requires, among other spectacles, thunder and lightning, Oseas appearing above the stage with an angel, a fire that consumes the king's advisor, a tree rising from under the ground, and the appearance of a hand holding a burning sword emerging from a cloud. Thomas Dekker's play, Old Fortunatus, sees fortune grant to Fortunatus the choice of certain gifts. He chooses the bottomless purse of gold, spurning, among other things, the gift of wisdom. And in that choice, you can imagine the outcome of the play. He travels the world, but turns squanderer and thief, stealing a magic hat that transports the wearer immediately anywhere he wishes to go. He is killed by fortune for his misdeeds. His sons inherit both purse and hat, but again corruption follows. One son takes the purse and later steals the hat from the other. In turn, he is duped by the English king's daughter, and attempting to regain the purse, both brothers fall foul of the court and are slain. The action is framed and contextualized by the debate between fortune, vice, and virtue as to who is greatest. Virtue, not surprisingly, prevails. The staging requirements include fortune with her wheel and globe, vice and virtue, each with trees, and the magic of appearing and disappearing. Friar Bacon and Friar Bungay sees Edward, the Prince of Wales, fall in love with Margaret, the fair maid of Fressingfield. He hopes to seduce her with the help of Friar Bacon's magic. He sends his friend Lacey to court her with the help of Friar Bacon's magic. He sends his friend Lacey to court her on his behalf, but Lacey falls for Margaret himself. The king, Henry, is entertaining royal guests, including the king of Castile and his daughter Eleanor, the intended bride for Edward. Edward resiles his claim on Margaret and accepts Eleanor as his bride. Lacey convinces Margaret to marry him. The action is interlaced with the magic antics of Bacon and Friar Bungay, sometimes in friendly competition, sometimes as confederates, and in one instance, defending the reputation of English necromancy in the face of competition from Germany. However, Bacon's magic leads to death and disaster, and he finally resigns from his craft. Overall, magic is seen to cause trouble where love can lead to resolution. There are four main magical effects that I will demonstrate today: thunder and lightning and flames, a dragon, a tree, and ascending and descending objects. First, thunder and lightning together. Thunder and lightning in plays of this time signal the supernatural. Think of the opening of Macbeth. The witches appear with the thunder and lightning. This combination of effects sets the scene for magic and the supernatural on stage, evoking a particularly fearful response in the audience. So how were thunder and lightning produced? Leslie Thompson outlines that the sound of thunder came from drums, although the rolling of cannonballs is also possible, while lightning, which I'll turn to in a minute, was produced by fireworks. So this is what it could have looked like backstage. As you can see, we've opted for the ball rolling form of thunder, although there are other methods aside from the drum as well. And yes, cannonballs could be that size. The cannonballs roll across the tiring house floor, picking up additional sounds as they cross the floorboards. Despite this, I would like to see them embedded into a groove in the floor so that they don't present another obstacle for actors coming and going to change costume amid an already crowded tiring house. The tiring house that Sarah's just shown you is empty aside from the cannonballs. Once there are costumes and all the required props and the actors who are not required on stage, it gets very full, and I can't see beyond the purposes for today's demonstration. I can't see the cannonballs being allowed to take up that much space. Okay, closely related to thunder is the object that would have illustrated lightning, as well as a number of other spectacular effects. The firework known as the squib was most common. This is a contemporary Chinese squib. I wasn't able to find a squib of the day, but it gives you an idea, and I'll explain a little bit more about it in a moment. So Philip Butterworth outlines that a squib squirmed erratically to produce a fizzing shower of sparks that sometimes ended in a small report. And he says the unpredictable behavior of the firework induced a gleeful panic among spectators when thrown among them. And the fireworks that you saw were imagining that someone backstage would have lit the fuse and then thrown them on stage in just that way. Butterworth describes the squib thus. It consisted of a strengthened paper tube or coffin, and you get the idea from this image here, and contained two kinds of mixtures. Roughly two-thirds of the coffin contained slow composition or mealed powder, and the smaller section of the coffin held corned powder, which provided the final report. The coffin was not much thicker than a goose quill, so narrower than what you can see here, and about 4 inches long. A division was created between the two powders by choking the coffin with packthread. The basic powder mixture created the shower of sparks, which in turn ignited the corned powder to produce the report. Numerous recipes still exist for making the firepower and the objects which contained the explosives, all using ingredients that appear to have been readily available, such as rosin, aqua vitae, corn powder, etc. The theatrical value of squibs and larger fire effects included creating the necessary spectacle, suggesting and intensifying the supernatural and magic, and providing a distraction so that other things may take place, actors entering or exiting, or props being transported on or off stage relatively unobserved. It is likely that the squibs produced more smoke than we have reproduced thus far, although the smoke effects appear slightly more prominently in the version of the model that incorporates more internal lighting. The shadows capture the smoke on screen. If smoke were required as an effect in its own right, it could be produced in different colors, including black, brown, white, yellow, and red. A more complicated fire effect takes place in A Looking Glass for London, where the king's advisor dies by being engulfed in a flame that the script suggests emerges from the trap. We have positioned the trap in a comparable location to where it is at the Globe, although the smaller stage requires a proportionately smaller trap. This trap door has hinges appropriate to the day. They could have opened up and out or down into the trap. Here is Radagon from A Looking Glass for London being engulfed in flames, which is punishment for his many sins, notably the denial of his parents and then abandoning them to destitution. The actor achieves this effect by descending a few steep steps into the trap. While it is a steep descent, it would be manageable for a fit actor. I'll just let Sarah show that again. So you can see that there are two cresset torches, the metal flame holders, providing the illumination while, we hope, preventing the theater from burning down. Rushlights are an alternative to the cresset torch. The addition of mirrors or bits of reflective agents could further enhance such a spectacle. This effect is relatively easily realized with only the need for one assistant under the stage. There are other possibilities to achieve this effect. Butterworth speculates about blowing explosive powder through a tube towards a flame also positioned in the trap, for a sense of fire appearing below the stage. I'm not certain that the spectacular effect of this method would, however, be great enough to suggest a fire sufficient to dispatch Radagon. One might think that these effects would be too dangerous to mount in a theater, particularly a wooden theater. But Butterworth reminds us that our contemporary mindset that pulls us towards negating evidence because of our own preoccupations with issues of safety must not be allowed to interfere with the evidence and what it tells us. This has been confronting for us as we have developed these special effects. The default action for us today is to assume the authority of today's Occupational Health and Safety Code. And this is very relevant for the next item of wonder. Taking the use of fireworks a step further to a creature that could emit fire, we have investigated the potential for a three-dimensional dragon to introduce yet more of the effects of the natural, of the supernatural and spectacle. Henslowe's diary lists such a creature, although, as usual, without a description of size, shape, materials used in construction, color, etc. Yet coronation ceremonies in both 1487 and 1533 record the presence of dragons or comparable monsters, even large-scale ones that contained a human operator who would activate sprays of sparks. So we may not need to be modest in thinking about the shape of a stage dragon. Here are some images from Butterworth's study, Theater of Fire, that illustrate the kinds of effects that could have been elicited. Do you want to just repeat those two? Go back to the, yeah. These models of what apparently was achievable in the day are, I think, quite significant for helping us think a little bit more broadly about the nature of this spectacle than we might otherwise. It is one thing to read about these creatures and their effects, of course, another to see what they might have looked like in a venue where they were known to have been used. A dragon is required in Friar Bacon and Friar Bungay. The stage directions indicate, here Bungay conjures, and the tree appears with a dragon shooting fire. Some commentators assume that the dragon rests in the tree, but we have not taken that as read, partly so that we could also experiment with the flight, so to speak, of an object on this stage. The possibility of a flying dragon is not mere speculation. Cara Riley notes that John Dee's production of Aristophanes' Pax, or Peace, at Trinity College, Cambridge in 1547, included the actor playing Trigeus being transported in a flying beetle up to the roof of the college. Here is our dragon. From a second perspective. So we decided to make the dragon fly from one fixed location, the Tiring House, to another, the gallery above the main entrance to the theater, over the heads of the standing audience. Having it fixed on a line would still preserve the spectacle while keeping it manageable for an unknown number of assistants who may have been backstage. We have experimented with the angle of the dragon's travel. In fact, a steeper angle that takes him to the top of the theater is also mechanically achievable. We imagine that there would be squibs in his mouth and that the body of the dragon could be made from papier-mâché or from canvas on a light frame. The color, like our hellmouth, is speculation, of course. Our dragon can be managed in the Tiring House without too much interference to or from other traffic. The rope can be secured at the gallery level before the performance begins, with a stage anchor point over the Tiring House door on the inside, either ready to be just kind of jiggled down or to be moved to an anchor point at the back of the Tiring House using a hook and screw eye when the dragon's cue comes. We envisage the dragon hooking on and off the rope, just as he might be hooked on and off the Tiring House ceiling or high up on the walls there when he was not needed. This then requires one person backstage to secure the rope, to set the dragon in place, light the squibs, while a second person at the other end pulls him up into place. The mechanism is even simpler than the rope pulley system that would have been used to rig sails on ships. But that is an option as well, especially if the rope was being pulled from backstage. We imagine the dragon remaining where he is at the resting point above the entrance to the theater itself until the play is finished, out of sight of the main action. We experimented with someone trying to take him off of the rope in an imaginary mid-performance, and that was just way too difficult. So having him rest there, vaguely out of hand's touch from the people sitting in that gallery, seemed to be the best option. I like the idea of the dragon extending beyond the stage, taking flight above the standing patrons. It accounts for the spectacularity required by any play that calls for such a creature, particularly if there is more smoke circulating in the theater. The possibility of the dragon appearing from the trap, which Green stipulates in the script, could be achieved by lifting a smaller dragon. It would have to be quite a bit smaller than the one you've just seen. Lifting a smaller dragon from the trap door and using a hoist, and hoists are the final item, which I'll turn to shortly. A trap dragon would also need to have detachable wings. The next item is the use of trees on stage. Speaking of trees on stage, I do not mean the imagined forest that provide the setting of As You Like It or Love's Labor's Lost, but specific property trees required to appear on stage to serve the plot, such as the tree that Green stipulates in the same scene as the dragon in Friar Bacon and Friar Bungay. How would the early modern theater have staged such trees? Certainly the stage columns could have become useful as trees on this occasion, and no doubt they were, just as they are at Shakespeare's Globe today. But the nature of the trees required in several plays suggests something more than the posts to be leaned on or hidden behind. We haven't included the posts or the canopy roof in the rows because they obscure sight lines, but it's very easy for us to put it in and even have a button that will make them disappear if need be. But back to the trees. Henslowe's diary records a tree of golden apples, which I interpret to be a physical object, not a sheet or anything just single-dimensional. All three plays require trees to appear physically and variously to produce fruit and even to be climbed. How would such a tree arrive on the stage? It could be lowered from above, which I'll turn to in a moment. It could be introduced from the tiring house, possibly on a wheeled platform. It could be brought in via a groove in the stage floor. While these options are possibilities, we decided to explore the tree emerging from the trap. Now, this is Henslowe's golden tree, of course. This presupposes a tree of a particular size, but still one that is three-dimensional, not a cutout, and that can appear and disappear. It requires two people to raise, one to slide the base of the tree, which is positioned on a stand with two crossed bits of wood, and the other person to control the middle of the trunk, guiding it up through the trap. Its removal would simply be the reverse. It is possible that it can be placed on a platform just under the stage to provide it sufficient height. A tree appears early in the play Old Fortunatus in a debate between virtue and vice, where each seems to have a tree. We've only done one so far. And later, the stage property appears again when Fortunatus's son, Andalusia, comes across a tree in a wilderness. There is sufficient action on stage in the meantime that we have assumed that the tree has been removed and brought back out again, rather than simply remaining on stage through the performance. Andalusia climbs the tree to pick an apple, which he eats. He then attempts to pick a particularly high apple, and even, the play tells us, fishes with his girdle for it before returning to the ground. I have to say that our tree hasn't quite come into apple season yet, as it were, but I imagine that apples could be tied on, since they need to be removed from the tree. For Andalusia to climb the tree to harvest an apple from the top, we would need to have him step up on something like a box. We couldn't manage, with the scale of the object and the size of the trap door, for the tree to be big enough for him to actually climb, even if he were played by a boy actor. Our tree is not quite as sturdy as that required to hold Horatio's body weight in Thomas Kyd's The Spanish Tragedy, but other options could have been available for that spectacle. My point is that this venue provides structural limitations to the type of tree that could have been produced as part of the spectacle, but that certainly doesn't remove the impact of the spectacle taking place. The effect of the tree is to combine the natural world, literally nature, and the magical world, a magic golden tree produced in the case of old Fortunatus by godly figures. The necessary spectacle of the supernatural heralds the shift in worldview while continuing to reinforce the power of the fable itself and its direct connection to audience members. The final special effect is the raising and lowering of objects or actors, something that theaters of the day were known to have been able to support using the rigging system of ships' pulleys. Such lifting devices were well known, at least in the later medieval theater tradition, so it is hard to imagine that this technology was not transferred into dedicated theater buildings as well. In A Looking Glass for London, each of the five acts sees the appearance and disappearance of an angel who, with the prophet Osias, warn Londoners that they will suffer, as did the Ninevites, if they don't improve their ways. Now, the angel and the prophet here are rigged so that they can stop, or as you see, they can come all the way down. Osias remains on stage above the action at that first point until the end of Act 4. He's just there for almost the entire play, while the angel continues to appear and disappear. We've not quite worked out how to have the angel carry Osias, as the script suggests might take place, because of the weight of the pulley system. That's not to say that it can't happen, just that we haven't completed the calculations yet. Our solution at this stage is to put in two cranes. We know that in 1595, Henslowe installed a throne that could be lowered, a device that's necessary for Dr. Faustus, and it's not impossible that there were two such cranes that operated like this. The actor could be lowered, as is required for Looking Glass in London, or he could be lowered to the ground, as I mentioned, and step off onto the stage. It is even possible that the angel might disappear into the trap using much the same means that Radagon did. We have used slightly smaller actors, imagining that boys or lighter men would have been used for these roles rather than the more robust actors. It is also possible that one crane could have supported both actors suspended from a bar. The hauling of two actors at once on one bar would have been more difficult for the people backstage, but definitely not impossible. The effects of this relatively simple hoist device and its various manifestations preserve the realm of the supernatural, since this is a recognized means of introducing gods onto the stage. Think of Cymbeline, where Jupiter descends to the stage on an eagle's back. It also reinforces the value of the spectacle. While we are only demonstrating relatively simple vertical lifts here, the system that enables a dragon to fly could also be used to fly a human across the stage or in and out of the trap or above the heads of the spectators in the pit. Like the tree, it demonstrates the shift in the worldview to one where once humans are raised and lowered, human agency can compete visually with divine power and authority. Several of these plays provide other challenges that we haven't addressed yet, including in A Looking Glass for London, a serpent climbing a large vine that's large enough to shelter Jonas before the serpent devours the vine, Jonas being expelled from a whale's belly, the angel appearing and vanishing repeatedly, and as I mentioned earlier, the arm appearing from a cloud holding a sword. But the foundations for engineering these spectacles are in the devices and effects that I've demonstrated today. Detailed information about staging effects has not endured. Leslie Thompson notes that the lack of evidence about how these effects operate implies that such details in play scripts or accounts of theater were unnecessary because those responsible for the effects knew how to achieve them. Some sense of how they were realized is now possible using contemporary research methods and traditional ones. There is also scope for investigating more aspects of the logistics of performance that are equally essential to our understanding of theater of the day. The exploration of these devices leads me to want to investigate other matters. For instance, how would these effects have operated on other stages of the day? And how would the staging and performance have altered with the advent of indoor theater? It would, funding willing, be exciting to work on a model of an indoor theater like Blackfriars to study just these shifts. It would also be possible to provide a thorough examination of a matter Alan Dessen takes up, that of the use of the various doors on stage. He says, given the demanding repertory system, with up to 6 different plays performed each week, according to Henslow's records, did the players have to keep track of which door to use for entrances and exits, something rarely noted in the extant manuscripts and printed texts, unless the situation calls for some special effects? Or was there some less cumbersome, more efficient approach? More recently, Tim Fitzpatrick has explored what he thinks must have been an implied understanding of the meanings associated with each stage door. A 3D model of a theater enables detailed physical research on such physical staging questions, partly because it is 3D and partly because it is easy to save versions, to try new options, and then to draw conclusions from comparing them. Other issues that continue to intrigue me include logistical matters about performance, storage, and staging assistance. Neil Carson argues that the rows would have been more cluttered than is sometimes imagined. But it is the Tiring House that particularly captures my attention. This backstage area would have been much more fully deployed than one might think, questioning just how functional it could have been. This is before one even considers the practicalities of some of the more complex props. How are these props stored during a performance, let alone the question of where they remained when the performance was finished? Who assisted with the movement of properties on a very cramped stage? How many people were required? A VR model can illustrate that crowded atmosphere, but it can do more. It can also enact the larger, more sensory effects of performance. Several critics have explored in print additional sensory engagement with performance. Jonathan Gill Harris brings smell to a study of squibs and their potential. Squibs, made from, among other things, saltpeter, would have been particularly strong smelling. He notes, if saltpeter's fecal origins were not enough, gunpowder's customary mode of preparation served to amplify its malodorousness. Its ingredients, he says, must be compounded with the oil of eggs and put under hot dung for a month. Meanwhile, Bruce Smith discusses the soundscapes of early modern theater and life. He asks, what kind of sounds could the theaters produce? What constituted the repertory of sounds on which playwrights and actors could draw? What qualities of the human voice figured in this repertory? We may not be able to reproduce the smells of theater yet, but it is possible to generate sounds and even have sound waves bounce, as it were, off the wood. We haven't achieved it yet, but it is possible. Even if we can't reproduce smell, the VR model can contribute to generating the sensory quality that comes from inhabiting, as it were, a theatrical venue in a way that is just not possible on paper. Using virtual reality tools enables us to think of 3D activity in 3D, or in as close to 3D as we'll get, not just on the page or simply in the mind. This is, then, a semblance of what William Pohl sought in his experiments 100 years ago. Although our investigations demonstrate that a theater such as the Rose would have been much darker, smaller, smellier, and more crowded than he imagined. Nevertheless, the evidence of the stage directions in plays that were performed at the Rose indicates that they required spectacle, and the audience expected the same. Barbara Hodgdon calls her theatrical investigations, in the context of what can be deduced about performance from the archives, never the thing itself, only a simulacrum. This is an appropriate description for the form of research in which I've been engaging too. But it is a simulacrum that can begin to reveal a different type of knowledge than the archives have offered. It is a simulacrum that can lead to a more haptic or physical picture of performance in early modern times. It is true that we may never know exactly what spectators of the day thought of these devices, but that doesn't preclude the potential for exploring more about the theaters of this era and the performance that took place on them. Further, I'm not insisting that the effects I have demonstrated are definitively what took place. Rather, they represent what effects could have transpired in a way that we haven't been able to speculate to this point. Just as theater of the early modern era witnessed a radical shift in the meaning and effect of magic and the supernatural, so too is research today on a cusp of change. The spectacle that this model is founded on, which entwines with traditional research. I hope that the technological devices I have shown you, which are neither diabolic nor natural, have intrigued you about the conditions of performance in early modern London as much as they fascinate me. Thanks very much. And thanks very much to Stu and Sarah as well.
Thank you very much, Joanne Tompkins. That was wonderful. I've been waiting for 2 years for that. And it's far more than my expectations. I'm sure you've got quite a few questions about elements of that fine lecture and all the illustration in it. Can we kick off with some? I've got one or two, but I'd like to hear from you first. Have we got another microphone out there? I've got. All right, use mine.
Thanks. I thought that was absolutely marvellous reproduction of the theatre. And it reminds me that you probably know this already, but in the virtual world Second Life, which I was in for a few years, an American woman had built reproductions of both the Blackfriars Theatre and the Globe. And in the Globe, she put on actual performances. She did 12th Night with actors from in their kitchens around the world, actually doing a performance live, and I wondered whether that was possible with your model, whether you could do a whole play with in real time with actors. And the second question I had is that, looking at that, I wondered, is it possible for these theatres to have had 2,000 to 3,000 spectators? I wondered whether you were able to simulate the number of spectators that could fit in.
Okay, there are two answers to the first question. In terms of Second Life, we have deliberately stayed away from Second Life because my interest in this model in the first instance was from spatial terms. What I research when I'm not doing this is spatiality in theater. And Second Life has a habit of distorting space. So I deliberately chose not to let this model go into Second Life because part of the value of it is the accuracy of the measurements. So that was one thing. The second thing about performance on it, it's eminently possible for us to mount a performance on it. It took a remarkable amount of time to generate that performance of Dr. Faustus that you saw, and that's just one monologue. It didn't take very long for the actor to learn the lines or to do the actions that were required to be captured in a motion capture suit. What takes so long is the data cleaning that has to happen afterwards. Once the data was cleaned, it was almost effortless to put it into our model. So it's just the process of motion capture so far is laborious. Now, we are hoping to, if grant willing, if we get a grant that we've applied for, we are hoping to do some short scenes from a couple of different plays on this venue and on a couple of others. It will take a lot of time and money to do that. What I'm also interested in is getting a second actor there. Currently, we've only got a moving figure of Dr. Faustus. I'd like to have two actors moving. We can have any number of static figures there, but not the moving ones. As for performance per se, it's not been our intention to recreate a full-scale performance because we're so interested in the details of the venue, of how different aspects of the venue actually operated. We may well get down the track to a full-scale performance. I think it's going to depend on technology, though, because, again, that accuracy that's so important in the shape of the rose is important to me in the nature of the moving image as well. So that's the answer to the first question. The answer to the second question about the 2,000 to 3,000 people, that's what it's designed for. Now, it wasn't often filled with 2,000 to 3,000 people. I think it mostly was filled with roughly two-thirds of an audience, according to Henslowe's diaries. We've just put those static figures in there to give a sense of what it would be like. Again, we are hoping to populate the theater with a much fuller audience. If we just do static figures, that's relatively easy, because if you look really closely, there's six faces that keep getting repeated. So we can add in an awful lot of people, but it's just the opportunity to do so. We haven't been able to do that yet. What you're seeing is very much work as it has, it's really hot off the presses. It's work that was just completed this past week. And we are working with every new bit of technology to try to improve it and to make it a little bit easier to do each of these steps.
Thank you.
When you ask your question, could you say your name first so we know who is speaking? Because all this is being recorded, it'd be nice to have that.
Okay, thank you. My name's Jackie Watson. I'm interested in the range of people who are in the theatre watching some of those effects. I'm very interested in the dragon and thinking about, and I notice obviously the way that they are at the moment, the characters in the yard didn't move and didn't look up and look aghast as the dragon went over them. And you imagine that they perhaps would have done, because for them underneath, the whole thing would have been sort of less explicable and just would have suddenly been shocking and arresting. I'm just wondering about the perspective, though, from other parts of the theatre, if you've got something that literally goes just above the heads of the people in the yard, and you've got people who are perhaps paying more money to sit further around and can see the mechanics of how all of this is working much more clearly, whether the aim of the dragon, if you like, is to shock and to kind of inspire awe, or whether it's actually just as interesting from the people's perspective above to say, oh yeah, that's how they're doing it, and that's really kind of interesting from a kind of generation of the effect point of view, and whether that would be kind of more appealing for those people or not.
Okay, that's a multi-part question as well. We're currently not able to have those standing figures have any kind of emotional response. They don't move at all, unfortunately. And again, we just as I'm trying to make trying to generate more actors on the stage with emotions, we've done a little bit of motion capture of people sitting, you know, being notional audience members, both sitting in the galleries and standing. We haven't been able to load that in there yet. So eventually there will be a responsive audience, at least a somewhat responsive audience. I'm hoping that your responses will fill that gap for now. One of my colleagues who made this found himself looking at the model, standing in the pit, and actually got shocked himself, even though he knew what was going to happen, because he forgot about the squibs going off effectively over his head, as you know, from his own perspective. Now, you can maneuver yourself wherever you like in this model, as Sarah's doing right now. You can position yourself from the perspective of any of these notional static figures or wherever you like. So it is possible to see the mechanics of the dragon or any of those other devices, and as one of the commentators that I mentioned notes, people would have known how the ship's pulley system or this simple system would have worked. So it wouldn't have been that they would have been necessarily thinking, as far as we can tell, oh, how did they do that necessarily? But at the same time, that spectacle is all important. You know, that's one of the reasons why they are going to the theater. They are expecting some form of spectacle. Now, as far as the spectacle that they are seeing, it's a bit like occupational health and safety rules. We have to think of it from a very different perspective than we do today. You know, for us, it might evoke some surprise. It's not scaring us like it could well have at the time. Scared the audiences. And I'm trying to think, was there anything else? I think that covers what you asked.
Thanks very much. Another one here.
Michael Holden. This is the second phase of The Rose, isn't it? But you haven't included stage columns. Is that a deliberate choice?
I missed the first.
You haven't put in stage columns.
That's right. We haven't put stage columns in, not because we don't know where they are, just because they obscure the sight lines. What I need to do is put them in so that you can press a button to see where they would have been and then press another button to have them disappear so that we can do what I've been showing you today. And we just haven't got to that stage yet.
Another one, thank you.
My question, sorry, Rosemary Yule's, relates to that, and that is the angel and the throne coming down from heaven, as it were. Does that mean they have to come through the canopy, which is currently not shown?
I was wondering about that just the other day when I was thinking, you know, exactly where would the canopy have been. The throne was known to have been put up on the gallery level just above the tiring house, and there's a door back there for access. So somehow there had to be a way for them to get down, which suggests that the canopy was at the next level up. And also, I think the canopy had to be at the next level up so that all the people in the rest of the gallery didn't have their sight lines obscured. Again, that's one of the things I'd like to experiment with. You know, try putting the canopy in several different spots and seeing what's going to be the most reasonable. This theater was also known to have been very heavily painted, and we just haven't had an opportunity to try to think about what the painting might have looked like.
Can I ask one?
Yeah, of course.
Of these flying devices that were obviously used, are there any descriptions at all from any source of how they might have flown? I was wondering whether the dragon might have come from the other end down onto the stage to assail the guilty one.
Yeah. Okay, two different questions there. The dragon coming from the other end of the theater onto the stage, logistically we couldn't make that happen. We did try, but it's just too difficult to put him in place at the appropriate time and have the ropes work in the appropriate way. At least if he's backstage, first of all, there's a little bit more of a surprise, a little bit more of a spectacle, and it seemed to work for us much better this way. Now, I may be putting in a 21st century fallacy by saying it worked better this way, but in terms of the logistics, I liked this a little bit better, too. And then you asked another question. Forgotten what the other part of the question was.
Was there another one? I think it was just reversing the process, I thought of. If there are any sources of how it might have worked.
Contemporary sources, yeah.
Not how it might have worked technically, but just the impact.
I've relied a lot on Dessen, who has gone through all of the plays to work out stage directions and what's there. And after reading him, my answer is there's not much left after what he's done. So, you know, the short answer is there's very little about these sorts of things.
Thank you. You better have this one.
Hello, David Brown. I'm fascinated by the tiring house and how full it got. Do you have any visualizations of that? That sounds really interesting.
Sarah can show you something from a previous iteration. So I've worked out all the props that were necessary for Dr. Faustus, because that's the play I worked on before this particular presentation. And I didn't actually worry about the things that weren't listed in the play. I just, you know, looked at the ones that were actually named in the play. We then did a model of them, or at least a model of the shape of them, and then put them all backstage. Now, it's a very basic model, a very basic scene, but it gives you a sense when you add costumes and all of these props and actors, they're really going to be tripping over each other. So this is Dr. Faustus. That's and again, this is not at all aesthetically worked out. This is just a practicality model. There's his study at the entrance. You'd have to think of some sort of a curtain to curtain off the tiring house. That is my costume bay over there. We can't actually create costumes yet, but I just thought about stacked clothes for all the many costumes that that play requires for the many actors. There's another option of, I don't know what you call it, but that system that you see in a lot of older houses for drying laundry that you can pull up by a rope.
Drying rack.
Pardon me?
The drying rack.
Thank you, drying rack. It's possible a drying rack could have put in, or just slack ropes to hang costumes over, but all of that also requires space. So there's just a couple of, again, static figures there to suggest actors backstage. And if you swivel around to the other side, Sarah, you've got, that's for the water to wet the horse courser, some embers, a banquet, a few more actors, and then you can see Orange Hellmouth standing up. We wanted Hellmouth to be able to be relatively compact, but you can see from that Hellmouth, that's not going to fit through the trap door. So that comes back to why we staged Hellmouth the way it is. Now, if you think about, again, the curtain, and then just the basic activity of people changing costumes quickly and trying to listen for their cue, there's not much room to move around there at all. And I'm learning from what we've done today, what I've shown you today, that there would also have, of course, been some assistants backstage. Maybe they were other actors who weren't required at the time, and maybe not.
Could I add something to that? On our website, it's about the tiring house. There's a C.W. Hodges sketch, a drawing of a tiring house. Hodges, I don't know if you've come across his work, but he's done some marvelous drawings of his impression of these old theatres. There are about 400 in the Folger Library website in Washington that you can call up and look at, and that's how I found some of these. And one of them is of the tiring house as he imagines it, and it's very full. And it's got things like the racks, it's got the ass's head for Midsummer Night's Dream hanging up at points, all sorts of things in the back there. Yeah. I think it's on the theatre. I think it's on the image gallery for the theatre site.
Yeah, and that begs the question of where were things stored when they weren't needed for the production. There was obviously somewhere else where things got stored, and the little room above the theater, above the tiring house, I just can't see would have been big enough to store very much at all. And especially if you just think about the large props that are required for Marlowe's plays alone, you know, some of those are very big. Hmm.
So where did the cannonball roll?
James Wallace, thanks, that was a great lecture. I was just wondering whether we could see the Hellmouth again, but we only got to see it from side on.
Oh, right,
whether we
okay.
could see it from some different yep. angles. And then while you're setting that up, just a plug. I know that there's a rare chance to see Friar Bacon and Friar Bungay perform. There's a staged reading of it for Shakespeare's Globe Red Not Dead series next Sunday at 3 o'clock.
Great, thank you. So if you happen to go, think about some of these special effects. Sarah will show you in just a moment. As I said, this is all work in progress, and there are different effects on different models, so they're just having to load a new one, load the one that actually has Hellmouth on it. We'll come back to you.
Sorry, I meant to ask earlier, Victor Keegan, is it possible to access your model online?
It's possible to see a short video online of the model. And that's just at our website, which is ortelia.com.au. And it's in the back of the...
How do you spell that, sorry?
It's in... Yeah.
Before we start, I'll take the reference, the URL.
Oh, right, okay. Thanks.
To be honest, Ortelia as a company is a commercial entity for our contemporary work, the work that we do with galleries and theaters and museums now. What I'm trying to do with the historical work, with this work, is to make it open access. That just hasn't been possible yet, but I'm hoping by the end of the year that it will be possible for anybody to access this and be able to also click on anything and find the rationale for why we made the decisions we made. And in the best possible worlds in the future, it should be possible for you to try out what you think should have happened at a particular point and see what see how it transpired. So,
Hellmouth.
If you just go forward, you should be able to look into his mouth.
Can we get round to the side of it so we're facing hell?
Sarah's just trying to engineer that now. You can see the ribs this way, too. And those teeth are simply canvas. Do you want to close them up? I think he's a bit lurid, but it certainly provides the spectacle.
How's that, James? Okay. The future is still orange. Any more questions?
Oh, Andrew. Question.
About the thunder roll, the rose did have a 14-foot long, an immense thing, that was a channel which could have been ideally used for rolling cannonballs down. That's something that was in the original. It's a mystery because it was in the tiring house and it would have caused major impediment for anybody walking. Walter Hodges has a lovely image of all the actors peeing into it as a means of... it's one possible explanation of it, but it seems to me the cannonball run would be an equally obvious one. But it would be a major impediment in that very limited space backstage.
Exactly. I'm aware of that. We discussed trying to create that, and we couldn't manage the logistics, so I thought better to leave it and try with something at least a little bit simpler to get the effect. But, we'll work on that a little bit more.
The effect certainly works, doesn't it? Mm. You remember when Julian Boucher gave his lecture down at the Rose site. We actually, he had a cannonball with him that they dug from the site, and we tried it along, and he almost fell over, Julian, when he heard it. It was very authentic sounding. Yeah.
Okay, I just had a suggestion about where some of the things may have taken place, and I was wondering about the space under the stage. And whether, because obviously you need to get under there to access the trap, and whether maybe the cannonballs down there, maybe, or as a storage space, perhaps.
It's a really good question. And for a while, we resisted even putting in a trap because of all of those questions about, well, where does the trap come out, and is it possible to use as storage? And there are commentators who say it is possible to use as storage, but I just can't imagine it could be, given that it's an earth floor. Given that London is damp, I just think if you put things there, it's a recipe for disaster. And there would have been moisture on the floor a lot of the time. So, I mean, maybe a cannonball is fine, but anything else is going to be a nuisance. And even a cannonball, you don't want to be hoiking that very large one up onto the stage very often. As for where it goes out, because I think the tiring house is very small for what it has to do, my bet is that the trap would exit out at the back of the theater. You might have seen in the model that the scene that Sarah showed a minute ago, there was a back door opening to the outside. My bet is that the trap would have been exiting somewhere around here underneath. It's from We haven't actually explored underneath because we haven't quite made all of that space live. Certainly the theater itself is live, but not underneath. It would be very interesting to explore what it looks like under there. And as Andy will tell you, there were shoes and things found in the excavation, so certainly people would have used it. I think we're going to have to investigate how much they would have used it and what they would have used it for.
Michael Holden again. By the early 1700s, the thunder runs are always up in the roof, often over the auditorium. Bristol is a current example you can still see. I doubt whether that's from 1750, but it probably is quite early. If you think about the structure, the higher it is in the structure, the better, because it's more fragile as a structure, therefore it vibrates much more, and it therefore transmits the sound of the cannonball. And, of course, we expect thunder to come from above rather than from below. So I think all of that was put up in the loft of the Tiring House area. I see no reason why it would be anywhere else.
How would you achieve the thunder-like effect? Because when we witnessed it down at the Rose, it was because of the effect of a sort of sound box underneath the platform.
Well, the traditional one from the 1700s, anyway, that we can see is simply a wooden trough. And there are little battens placed across the trough so that as the cannonball rolls, it bumps, and that creates the thunder sound, and the trough is the sounding board.
It's not a very big space to get a big sound, though, is it? I mean, you see what I mean by a sound? A sound box effect.
The impression we got in your oralization, I felt, was a very good one, and it felt as though the structure was transmitting the sound. And if you think about placing it high in a wooden jointed structure, there's lots of room for vibration to that, and I think that's where the thunder comes from as early as Elizabethan times, as the early modern, and it's certainly there 100 years later.
Well, that's something that we could try and see. You know, it comes back to Andy's question about the trough. If we can get the trough up there and make the effect work, it's possible. I can't say at this point until we try it whether or not it could work. Certainly, I couldn't find any evidence when I was doing the research for this of it being up there, but I didn't find any evidence that there wasn't either.
Thank you. Another one here at the back. Yeah, thank you.
Andrea Cantor. I have two questions, but I have to tell you, this is the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen.
Oh, thank you.
First of all, you showed us very briefly the patterns of sunlight on the stage. Is it true that the stage was in full light during the hours of performance?
Is it true
that the stage would have been in full light in the sun? Like, was it John Orwell who said it was in the manner of a great spotlight on the globe, and that's what that looks like?
Right.
The sun being... How much of the stage is covered by the sun during the hours of performance? Do you know?
Well, what we've got in this model is the 24-hour clock, obviously. So, you know, you wouldn't be performing at night. I'm not sure I can answer that right now.
Okay.
I'd have to go back to my notes about exactly what the angle of the sun was. Certainly a portion would have been, but it was designed so that the sun wasn't hitting the actor's eyes. Okay, so, yeah.
Okay, so one more question.
Okay.
Sorry, thanks. You say we when you talk about reconstructing the various stage effects. Are you working with academics or with professional stage designers?
Well, I'm the academic involved, and Bernadette, who's been doing a lot of research assistance for me, has a lot of experience with stage management, and my other two colleagues are much more the virtual reality experts. So it's a combination. Thanks.
On the lighting of the stage, the physical lighting of the stage for the sun, you're talking about the direction of the sun, is that right? We know that most of the platforms for the amphitheatre theatres were all in the same direction for afternoon performances at 2 o'clock. So certainly for, 2 till 5, is that right? Were they? That's right, yes. Right. So how would you answer that one?
I don't think you would.
All right, then. We'll pass on.
The type...
That's true. Yep. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Yeah. True enough. Yep. Thank you.
The neutral position for this model is roughly noon in London in summer, although we've got a very sunny day like today. I'm afraid I can't show you on this version. One of the other versions has the hours written on that dial, but this particular one doesn't. Sorry. If Sarah spends about 10 minutes, she can probably find it.
Is that the most recent?
No, it's not the most recent.
Sorry, don't know. Are there any more questions? Did you have your hand up? Yes, here.
Hello, Duncan Linsky. Given the similarity of the amphitheatres, how easy is it to take that model and then just to simply change the parameters so that it shows different theatres? Is that an easy thing to do, or is it fundamental to the way that that has been put together that it only shows the rows?
How do I answer that? There's no way we can modify this particular building to become something else. This is the rows based on those foundations. It's and the very tiny size of the rows. We couldn't just, I don't think we could just expand it and turn it into any of the others, like say the globe, which is also round. The other model that I referred to, the boar's head, is square, so it's totally different. We use the same principles to create it, but this has to be discrete. So we would like to do a version of the fortune. We'll start from scratch for that, based on the contracts that remain.
Thanks very much. In fact, I was going to ask you about the fortune, because I hope it forms part of a follow-on project that we've got in mind. Are you planning to do something based on the fortune contract?
It's part of our follow-on project as well.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Maybe we should talk, Morris.
We should talk again. Do you have any more questions here? We've had some really interesting ones. You hover with your... No, okay, right. No. You've got one more. Okay. Shall we make this the last one? We'd better...
Just to be absolutely sure, though, on the roses you're looking at it, when we go into the roses, it actually is now. We're just seeing... that's the bit on the extreme right, is it? If we go into the Rose Theatre... as it is in real life, we enter it, that it's the area on the extreme right of what you had on the screen.
Andy, can you help?
It's the opposite. Oh, the opposite,
right.
60% of the roads have been cleared, yeah. And it's the western 60%. If you think of the stage as being the north.
So if we're looking at that now. Where's
when you stand to look at the side, you're actually on the right-hand plane.
Yes. Right, yeah, that's so we're on the right hand, as you look at it, there, we're on the right.
If you stand at the entrance, Park Street now, at the entrance to the Rose site, you're at the entrance, is that right?
Yeah.
So. Yes, and the stage would have been opposite. Well, I mean, it's just that it's still... Yes. Yes, that's right. It's displaced by about 12 feet or something like that.
That's like walking in from Park Street,
yes.
which is where the street is, into the rows. And the section that's been excavated is on your left now. And the section that's not been excavated, where you stand when you're looking at the remains, is on the right.
Shall I give you the URL, how you can access the Ortelia model, if anyone wants to write it down? So this is www.ortelia.htm.
If you just want to go to the Ortelia homepage, it's just www.ortelia.com, and then you can search for the rose. That might be the easiest way to do it.
Jolly old Google.
Yeah, it's Google.
I think we seem to have come to an end there. Thank you immensely again, Joanne, Professor Joanne Compkins from Queensland University. Thank you for coming all this way and give us a marvellous lecture. Thank you. Thanks for coming along, and I hope to see you in 2 weeks' time for the next lecture with Jean E. Howard, who's going to talk about the places of places like Debtors' Prison, where some of the plays of the 1600s were based, and to use those sites to develop a kind of understanding of an interaction between theatre and London. So that promises to be an excellent lecture. Thanks for coming, and see you next time. Thank you.